ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
What strides has intelligent design made scientifically and intellectually over the years? And what remains to be done to overturn Darwinian naturalism? We'll find out in just a moment. Welcome, I'm Robert Crowther with the Center for Science and Culture, Discovery Institute. We have a great guest to talk with today. He is also going to be one of the stars of this year's Dallas Conference on Science and Faith, which includes some other superstars spotlighting exciting evidence in intelligent design and current state of the debate. People like Marcus Eberlin and Stephen Meyer. And for the first time ever, you don't even have to be in Dallas to take it all in live. You can attend live if you want and are there, but it is being live streamed this year, so you can watch online. You can get all the details and register for the conference at discovery.org/Dallas2021. As I mentioned, our guest today will be just one of the speakers at this year's Science and Faith Conference. For regular listeners, he probably needs no introduction, but I'll give a brief one anyhow. He's a mathematician and a philosopher. He is a pioneer of the modern intelligent design movement, I think it is safe to say. He's an author or editor of over 20 pathbreaking books on ID, as well as a writer of peer-reviewed articles on math and engineering, philosophy, theology. A few years ago, he sort of shifted his focus from active research and teaching, and we'll touch on that in a moment. But I am happy to have with us today Dr. William Dembski.
Rob, it's so good to be with you. We've known each other, I think, well over 20 years now.
That is right. I remember meeting you at a conference, I think at Seattle Pacific University, one of the early conferences that Discovery did on intelligent design.
That would go back.
Yeah, it does go back just a few years. So as I mentioned, you're a speaker at the conference, and we'll get to that in just a second. But I was hoping that maybe you could talk just briefly about what you've been focusing on the past 4 or 5 years and what brings you around to this issue again.
Yeah, I'd say that's about right. 4 or 5 years that I started devoting my attention mainly to business and then also some writing projects outside of intelligent design. So for instance, just this fall, we had a book, two co-authors and I, titled Dalco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. And this is a story that just intrigued me. There was this pitcher from the late 1950s who never made it into major leagues, but he was regarded as having the fastest arm ever. I mean, it was just phenomenal. And he was not bulky or anything, 170 pounds, 5'11". But people who saw him pitch, Bob Feller, Nolan Ryan, others said that he was the fastest of them all. But he never made it. I mean, his arm was good enough to get him in the Hall of Fame, but he struck out as many as he walked. And so, I mean, so he could strike out over 20 in a game, but still walk 18 or so. And then, he'd lose 8-3 or something like that. So, I mean, sometimes wow. You could get it together, but it's a fascinating story about, and he was a phenom at high school. But anyway, that's a book that came out, and it was something I have a love for baseball, and I wanted to do it. And as it is, he passed away on account of COVID. He was 80 years old. Wow. In April wow. of last year. So the biography came out. I mean, we had hoped that, he would still be around for it. But anyway, so I've basically the last 4 or 5 years, I've been able to do some writing projects of the sort that I wouldn't if I was really focused on intelligent design. One that's related is a biography that Bob Marks and I just did on Walter Bradley. And there's the Walter Bradley Center that focuses on artificial and natural intelligence distinction. And so we did a biography in honor of the founder of that center. And it's really quite a remarkable story of a man who really maintained his integrity, touched so many different fields, touched so many different lives and was just very high-powered academic, but also just a real love for humanity. So we did that. So I get to do just a lot of things that I might otherwise not have working with people. And so this business that I have does well, and it's focused on educational technologies. So one thing we did was, if you go magnifyingtheuniverse.com, it's an updated version of the Powers of 10 video where this was about 50 years ago, where you would look at something, maybe a couple on a lawn, and actually I think it was in Chicago, which is where I'm from, and then it just zooms in like a microscope or zooms out, and you see all these different powers of 10. So you get the large scale structure of the universe, and then also down to the very microscopic level. And this does that in a computer. Basically, you have a website that does that. So these are some of the types of things I get involved with. And, I think part of it is I obviously have a longstanding interest in education. I've been a professor. But I think there's also a sense, and this ties in with intelligent design, that one of the reasons we have not seen these ideas succeed as much as they might is that we have an academy that's tends to be very resistant, that has assumed a materialistic or atheistic worldview by and large, or at least gives tacit consent to it. And, that makes it very difficult for intelligent design to succeed. So whereas we have come to this as intelligent design as a scientific program that challenges materialistic science, they turn it around and say, no, you're just a bunch of religious believers. This is really a science versus religion question. And they've, I think, been very successful in casting it that way. So there's always this burden or this uphill battle, it seems. And so that's why I wanted to look at education, step back a bit and see what's really going on there. Are there some ways of approaching education that will, as it were, do an end run and allow intelligent design to prosper? I mean, I don't want to mean it, to put it simply in terms of that.
Sure.
Looking at education instrumentally to get intelligent design there, I've real interest in. I think there are things that need to be done to reform and advance education in and of itself. But there is that intelligent design connection, because I think I experienced it firsthand where I was in a faculty position and had a center on intelligent design shut down, and it was through enormous pressure by Darwinists, materialists, just saying that this was not science, and so I have some experience there. And so that's, so my blog, it's, freedom, technology, education, those are the themes at BillDempsey.com. And then there's a quote from Epictetus, only the educated are free. And that's kind of where I'm focused, but I still have my fingers in intelligent design. I actually got back the rights to the Design Inference, which was published with Cambridge University Press in 1998. And for years, I'd been thinking that I should do a second edition of it, but I resisted it in part because I knew that the press wasn't behind the book, because the editor there who had shepherded it through, he was very kind to me, died of cancer not long after the book came out. But I was hoping to do a sequel to it, and the book was very well received, reviewed, sold very well for that type of book for Cambridge University Press. But he let me know in no uncertain terms that the syndicate in England, which usually rubber stamps whatever the American side recommends, said, don't think that your next book is going to fly with the syndicate, even if the academic board here on this side of the Atlantic signs off on it, because there's some biologists there and they don't like what you're doing.
Wow.
So at that point, I just thought, well, what's the point? So I ended up publishing the sequel. It was titled No Free Lunch Elsewhere. And then I think that just took the wind out of my sails, because the book is now dated. I mean, it's 22 years old that it's
sure.
been, or 23 years that it's been out. So, I'm actually, I got the rights back, and it was funny, within a week they gave it. It was like, we're glad to be rid of this. But, you know, the thing is, I can always say, hey, you know, I did publish the first edition with Cambridge, you know, and it went through the whole peer review process because it was an academic monograph. And so I'm working with a co-author, Winston Ewart, who is extremely bright computer scientist, PhD. And he and I have collaborated on a number of articles, book on evolutionary informatics. And so he and I are working on the second edition. So it's, I keep my fingers in intelligent design. You know, there was one point in 2016 where I said, well, I'm retired. And, you know, now I'm, you know, it's not quite like Michael Jordan coming out of the Wizards, you know, but it's a semi-retirement or semi-retirement. You know, it's like I keep my fingers in it.
Sounds like it, yeah. It must be exciting to kind of watch from the sidelines, so to speak, after having been involved so much yourself. And, you know, sometimes it's good to have a little step back and a refresher and a breath of fresh air sort of for yourself as you reinvigorate some of these ideas. And now you're looking at maybe updating older books or launching into new books, writing about baseball. I mean, that has to be a nice thing to be able to catch your breath that way and then sort of look at, well, where do I go from here and where does intelligent design go from here?
Yeah. Well, and that's right. I think maybe after 25 years really working hard in this area, maybe I thought I was getting a little bit stale. I'd done my best work. And I think a vacation is good sometimes. And I think, you know, so I'm hoping to come back at some point, perhaps guns blazing again. But in terms of what I see with the movement as a whole, I mean, it's very promising. I mean, I don't think we've won the day internationally, you know, where people are saying, okay, Darwin is dead. I mean, you know, because you see in popular books, I mean, just how much these Darwinian materialistic ideas have seeped in, you know, and so things are interpreted in an evolutionary light, even though it's really not necessary to the argument or the book that you give it, let's say, an evolutionary psychological spin or something. But they do it, you know, and so it would be nice to see intelligent design as a, you know, imbue itself in the culture in that way. I don't think we're there quite yet. But there was a meeting about a year and a half ago or 2 years now, I guess, in California, where it was a kind of a retrospective of this Howard Dunes meeting that Philip Johnson had organized in 1993, right, which I'd been a part of, and some other key people in the ID movement. And so we were there together, some of the people who were at the original conference, as well as a lot of newer faces. And it was encouraging to see the newer faces and also see just what's happening internationally. And the sort of resistance that intelligent design has faced in the U.S., it seems much less in other countries. I mean, Brazil, it was jaw-dropping for me to see Marcus Everlin and just what's on there. I mean, it seems like it's an open door from the Department of Education to get these ideas into the academy at all levels. So that's encouraging, you know. And I think there's movement in Europe, elsewhere around the globe. It reminded me of this. There was this paleontologist from China back 20, 25 years ago. I think the last name was Chen, where he said, you know, in China, you can't criticize the government, but you can criticize Darwin. Here it's the reverse. So it reminded me of that. And there is this sense of this lock on the educational system here. I think that, you know, our ideas are getting out there, certainly, but it's, you know, this sort of winning of the day, you know, that's... I remember I was helped organize a Mere Creation conference at Biola in 1996. And after that event, I think a number of us were feeling a bit triumphalist. And I thought that when I hit retirement at age 65, that we would have won the day. But, you know, here I am now, going to be 61 this year. And, you know, I do think we have the better arguments, the better ideas. You know, I'm thoroughly committed to that. But when I say that, what always comes to my mind is this New Yorker cartoon where an attorney sits across from somebody and says, "Well, you have a very good case, Mr. Pitkin. Now, how much justice can you afford?" You know, and I think that's the sort of thing. You know, it's how, you know, it's one thing to have the ideas, even to articulate them. It's another thing to get them out there. What I do actually with my websites, I mean, it's one thing to develop the content. We can have content that's better than what's out there, but then you still have to market it. You got to sell the ideas. You got to get it across in a way that people will say, yes, this is a better approach. And that's, yeah. I think that's where it's tough because, I mean, you know, we work on a shoestring compared to what the other side has in terms of.
Right. Research. When you think about how many biology departments there are at how many universities around the world that are essentially just, you know, pushing one point of view from the idea of Darwinian naturalism, you know, it's amazing because there aren't as many resources on our side, perhaps. But one of the interesting things is like this Dallas Conference on Science and Faith is becoming more and more of a major ID event each year. I mean, the last 2 years, 2019 and 2020, those videos of the presentations there have now been viewed more than 2 million times on YouTube.
Wow.
The speakers, Jim Tour, Stephen Meyer, this year, Marcus Eberlin from Brazil is going to be there with you. Yeah. You know, there's some really top level people that are making top line arguments. And arguments win out, even if you don't always have all the resources at your disposal. So I guess this is kind of the sort of thing you'll be talking about the conference this year. Can you give us a little sneak peek at what that might entail?
I think I'm looking to give a little history. You know, I mean, you know, and I think we've had some ups and downs. I think the point I made about the arguments being better, you know, the case being better on our side. I think there's some very powerful ideas that we've developed, I think, on the theoretical side with Bob Marks, evolutionary informatics, these conservation of information principles, which once you understand them, there's no going back to Darwinian evolution. Because basically Darwinian evolution, where it gets its power is in playing a kind of shell game where you think that this information is coming from nothing. And in fact, it's always being inserted. It's being smuggled in. It has to be there. Mathematics, I think, really nails that down. So, but the problem is, you know, a lot of the people in the scientific community, they don't even want to bother with it. I think there are a lot of biologists who aren't that mathematically facile, but the problem is, in general, they don't even want to expose themselves to these ideas because they know it can't be right. Right? I mean, what can you know somebody like Bob Marks and Bill Dembski? How can we have anything that really makes a difference? So I think there's this reluctance even to engage the ideas, and then you know I think on the practical side, on the research side, you have work by people like Doug Axe, which really does the painstaking work of showing how unevolvable certain proteins are, you know, and so just reviewing though the power of some of these arguments and then trying to give look in the crystal ball a bit and see where are these things going and where might we succeed in ways and at a level of intensity that we haven't seen. I remember when I used to go to college campuses and speak on intelligent design, I'd get good audiences, I mean, sizable audiences. And, you know, usually, I mean, my goal would be to try to make intelligent design seem plausible to at least some people. People came in thinking that there couldn't be anything there. Now, if I got people to say, okay, this is worth a second look, you know, often I felt that I had succeeded there. But, you know, can we take it further, you know, where it's like, hey, this really is a slam dunk, you know, and what would it take to get it to be a slam? I don't have, you know, I'm still thinking about the talk, what I want to say. And I think there's also just a matter of being a bit realistic. You know, I think it's easy to get triumphant, like I was after that conference, you know, I'm thinking we're going to have this all sewed up by the time I hit retirement at age 65. Well, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. But, you know, history is past. And how do we get, what's the path to getting where we want to, you know, and are there some mistakes we've made that we need to correct? So these are the sorts of things I want to look at in my brief talk.
Yeah, it's interesting looking back at the history, looking at where we're going to be going, talking about how do you get people interested in this topic, and then how do you, you know, excite them further. You were mentioning the Powers of 10 video, showing people things like that, and they see this, and then explaining in accessible terms and ways that they understand what the math is behind it, where the information is coming from, or where it isn't coming from, as the case may be. I think showing people those kind of things and having examples of that from the real world is what excites them. People love science and they love to see it in action and understand how intelligent design is approaching that, you know, the natural world and looking for the evidence of design. Yeah. So those are great things to do to get people interested.
Yeah. You know, and as you're speaking here, you know, I think of the Illustra media videos and Unlocking the Mystery of Life.
Yes.
Just huge, you know, and just the video, which by contemporary standards, the animation of what's going on in the cell might be considered a bit crude, but, you know, it was still, and I think it remains to this day, still enormously influential in moving people. And there's something about this imagery to see it, you know, see what's actually going on in the cell represented in a way that is, you know, very appealing, compelling, makes things intuitively clear. That, you know, I think goes a long way. And I think that's the sort of marketing we need to be doing a lot more of, it seems.
I agree with that for sure. The Dallas Conference is a great place for people to get a little taste of this. But you also have one other project I want to touch on briefly coming up that is you're working on a book with Casey Luskin. It's due out later this year from Harvest House. And right. It's titled The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith,
right.
Which makes it sound like it's going to be quite a weighty book.
It is. I mean, I think it's got close to 50 articles, lots of contributors. So it's, you know, I think originally it was the Harvest Handbook of Science and Faith. And then because it got so big, and it was going to be the complete Harvest Handbook. And then somebody was replying, well, if it's complete, you know, nothing's ever really complete. So then we went, okay, let's go with comprehensive. But it's quite a collection. I mean, it's four parts, each with about 12 articles, science and faith, science and design, science and evolution, and then hard questions on science and faith. So I've got three articles in there. You know, but Doug Yaks, I mean, all the usual suspects are in there, and it's great to have Casey back in the mix. I mean, get the original contributors and shape the volume, but then Casey, it fell on his shoulders to do a lot of the editing and just as things were coming in to organize it. So he just did a terrific job. And I should also mention Joe Holden, president of Veritas Evangelical Seminary. He's the third editor on that volume.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it's, I think, you know, it's a lot of good stuff. I think it'll give readers a comprehensive guide to science. And yeah.
Well, that's great. That'll be out later this year from Harvest House. And people will be able to get more information on that as usual at evolutionnews.org. I'm sure we'll be covering it and probably interviewing you and others about more aspects of the book.
Right.
And I also want to remind people, the Dallas Conference, you don't have to be in Dallas this year to attend. You can get it online. It is going to be live streamed on February 20th. The speakers, besides Bill Demsky, includes Stephen Meyer, Marcus Eberlin, Melissa Kane Travis, Casey Luskin will also be there. And that is on Saturday, February 20th. If you want to register, either to attend or to just watch online, go to discovery.org/Dallas2021. That's discovery.org/Dallas2021. You'll find it, but don't miss the opportunity because this is, I think, going to be a great conference, and it's always been a big hit, and I expect this one will be too.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Demski, for being here, and we will look forward to talking to you again in the future about other things and see where we're at with your crystal ball and others as we go through time.
Very good, Rob. Great catching up with you, and hope we can visit person to person sometime soon.
Yeah, hopefully soon sometime. Yeah. All right, for ID the Future, I'm Robert Crowther. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.